And it's the thinking at Ford in the 50s and 60s as to how it should be used, or why it should be not used. Or
yeah, I think that that is the planning and the strategy about front-wheel drive really came in when we started, when we said we wanted to compete in a small car market called the Falcon. Mm-hmm. Ended up as the Falcon at that time. The Europeans had a program called the Cardinal, which was a front-wheel drive car, and the original Falcon concept was in fact going to be a front-wheel drive car. At that time, again, front-wheel drive is nothing. It was invented about 50 years ago, 55 years ago or so. It's nothing new. It was always employed on smaller cars in Europe, and Ford of Europe had this, again, it was called Ford of Britain then in those days, but they had this Cardinal, which had a front-wheel drive that we had looked at for the Falcon.
At one point, I believe, just about the time you were graduating from the trade school, they were thinking of an immediate post-war small front-wheel drive, which was the Cardinal prototype.
Yeah. And I think they did one. They did one in Europe.
Right, they did.
The Ford, I remember the name of it. I can't recall the name of it, but I remember they had one in Europe way back. A predecessor to the Anglia, I think it was, yeah. But we had never done one here because basically we had never had a call for any small cars like that until the Volkswagen era, and then, you know, we responded with a Falcon at that time.
Was there some talk about for the Mustang initially?
No, the Mustang came after the Falcon.
Well, then,
yeah.
Of course, yeah.
The Falcon was the first one, and again they were gonna look at this Cardinal, but the front wheel drive did not win out at the time because our car called Falcon, even though it was small, was still bigger than what the European car was, and we elected to go rear wheel drive at the time because mm-hmm. we could use more common components. That was the first time we really applied the McPherson suspension. Because that was a car that was small enough in size to try that on, and then the Mustang, all those other came off the basic platform of that old Falcon. So
the Falcon program was quite a breakthrough for you in small cars. And did you remember any input that Robert McNamara had on that program, the body engineering of it?
Not really.
He was one of the champions of that particular vehicle.
I got in on the Falcon after the reorganization. The Falcon was out in production, and I get in on the Falcon when we start making it a muscle car. We start putting V8s in it, and we start putting higher option things. And the Falcon was designed as a very, very economical small car, and it couldn't take all these heavier loads, so we had to completely redesign the whole car. And at that time, you might recall, it was in a Monte Carlo rally.
Yes.
And they had a lot of failures when they put a V8 in it because the platform of the car was not strong enough to carry all this power and weight.
Right.
And so we had a complete, so I was in on the redesign of the Falcon, not the original Falcon concept as much.
So at this point, about 1971, you've got quite a career now.
Yeah, well, I progressed to executive engineer in the chassis organization, and that's where I was in 1971, working for Max Jurosik at the time. Max Jurosik was our chief engineer.
Spell his name.
Jurosek. He's now general manager of the powertrain division. And before him, it was John Manoogian. John Manoogian is our quality assurance executive director.
Spell his name.
Manoogian. Okay. Yeah. And then in 19, and again, Bob Alexander, who since retired, was our vice president of engineering.
You stayed with him for quite a while.
He was in this building here, see? But he had jurisdiction over all of the engineering function. And then Harold McDonnell was in the next office, and he was group vice president. He had engineering and planning. Okay.
Yeah.
And there was really. And then Gene Bordenay had design.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's the way the structure went. In 1971, I had the complete chassis and climate control, all of that part in the next building, Building 5.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Bastian, who was the vice president of Automotive Assembly Division in manufacturing, he wanted to know if I was interested in going to manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just jumped at the chance because I I wanted to, you know, again, diversify.
Sure.
So Bob Alexander asked me if I'd like to go over there. It was a promotion. So I went from executive engineer to assistant chief engineer in automotive assembly division.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I had my responsibility there was for all the tooling and facilities in all of our assembly plants, the manufacturing plants that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked directly for Marv Runyon. You know Marv, R-U-N-Y-O-N. He's now chairman of Nissan. Remember, he left our company and went to Nissan, Datsun. But Marv Runyon was a worked for Don Bastian then in the automotive assembly division. He had total, he was the general manager, and so I reported to him through a chief engineer, and then after a year over there, I became chief engineer of body and assembly division.
So now you're moving into the total package pretty much.
I moved from the planning engineering function into manufacturing.
Right.
And that was, I spent about a little over three years over there, but that was very, 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 probably, if somebody said, you know, looking back, what's a rewarding, I think that was one of the most rewarding and fun jobs that I ever had in my career, because the manufacturing is so, it's so interesting because of the spontaneousness of it. You can see the results of input tomorrow on production cars. You have a problem and you can analyze it, and you have to analyze and synthesize real quick, and if you don't, that car doesn't keep coming down the line, and it's a very, very fascinating end of the business, and I enjoyed it immensely. In fact, I asked Don Bastian when I went over there a few months after. I said, I don't want to work in a general office. I want to get out in the plant and really apply and really see what goes on. So even though I was pay grade wise, I didn't know it at the time, but I was like three grades higher than the plant manager down in Louisville. I asked him if I could go down there and work for the plant manager to run a launch of a car through production. And he has consented to that, so I spent the whole summer of 1972 in the Louisville plant and in the Mahwah assembly plant, which we've since closed because it was a two-shift plant, highly transient force. And I think I learned more in that summer than if I'd have stayed in the general office 3 years.
What was the launch?
A launch was the product coming out for production, the new product.
And which one was it?
It was a 1973 Ford, which was launched in 72, but it was the first year we had energy-absorbing bumpers and all those things, that the emissions on the car. I had responsibility.
I noticed you had emissions responsibility,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, in the general office, I had responsibility for that.
It's the beginning of government regulation.
Yeah, right.
Pretty much.
Right.
Probably a trying time for an engineer to have to put up with all these government types telling you what to do.
We had to use some, here's an interesting story about one of these doctors that Ed Morandi gave me. He came to work for me at AAD when I moved over there, and I put him on the emission job, and one of the emission jobs, we had to fill the cars up in the plant with special fuel when the emission laws came about, and AED had allocated $40 million to change all the fuel tanks in all the plants. That's what they had. That's
change
what
their
they were,
position?
To change the tanks so that they could put this special fuel in them,
so it
wouldn't get contaminated.
Yeah.
But this doctor, he was a doctor in chemistry, he found a way to flush the tanks and not have to change all the tanks through all the assembly plants. And because he was there and he had the knowledge to do it, we did it for $6 million instead of the 40-some million.
Wow.
So right, he paid for his he paid for his weight right there.
But the storage tanks or the
storage
fuel?
Tanks. Yeah, the storage tanks that we have in assembly plants that we use to, you know, get the fuel to fill our cars up.
Right.
But that was an amazing accomplishment there. Had Ed Morandi not given me that guy when I asked for him, I can't even think of his name, but he left the company. He went to another company, but he's the one that started the new laboratory on Greenfield in Greenfield and Rotunda. The Rouge Lab moved over there. And the name just slips me, Dave. I know him like the back of my hand, but I can't think of it right now.
So it had been for his
hasn't been for his, yeah, for his knowledge, which again he tied to the to how to do it a different way. We would have spent a hell of a lot more money than we actually
What'd you have to flush? What kind of liquid did you flush it with?
There's some kind of a solution that he came up with to flush these big tanks so that we didn't have to change them.
Uh-huh.
And it eliminated all the contamination that was in the tank.
Right.
so that they didn't have to go in and dig them out, because these were all underground buried tanks.
So did you recommend him for a promotion or a bonus?
Yeah, he did get a promotion, and he did end up running this Rouge Lab, but then he went to work for some other company at a better deal than he had here, so he left about, in fact, he left when I got back from Europe in about 79, 78 he left. But it was an interesting story.
Oh, that's fascinating, yes. So here you are in December of 1972, you've been named the AAD's, or the Automotive Assembly Division's Chief Assembly Engineer.
Yes, yes.
That must have been an awful responsibility.
It was a good responsibility, because I was able to apply then a lot of the knowledge that I learned from my jig and fixture days, how to draw parts, how to draw gauges. And when I went out, to my responsibility was the tools in the assembly plant to make the cars, to put the car together, to weld it, and I'd go out to suppliers. And I was able to be on, to know what they were talking about, because I had an understanding of the, not the manufacturability of that tool, but the way the tool was drawn, designed. So I had a little background that helped. Helped very much.
In a marvelous way, the background of your whole career is leading toward the complete package. You're now in charge of, in terms of putting it together.
Yeah.
Were there any particular heavy problems that you remember solving, or some interesting experiences on AAD?
Yeah. Yeah.
Stick in your mind.
One was a Dearborn assembly. We had a fire in the paint department. On a Friday night, and at that time Mustangs were selling like gangbusters. They were selling like cookies. And
what year was that?
1972, early 72.
You'd just been on the job for a time.
Early 72. Well, I've been on about a year, I guess, or something like that. Because I went over there as assistant engineer. I had never really had an appreciation for manufacturing people until that happened. I was only there a short time, because it really made the place, come together as a team, and what you could accomplish through team effort. Don Bastian, who was a very, very dedicated company man, vice president of
B-A-S-T-I-A-N.
Yes, yes. And he made a commitment to Mr. Ford, because we needed the cars, that we would be running by Monday. And this the paint department was all gutted. And I never saw so many people do so much work in such a short a time over the weekend. 24 hours a day the guys worked, and I was there part of the time with them. I was learning. Mm-hmm. And they had the paint department running first thing Monday morning. But that was a dedication that I said, oh my God, I used to deal with manufacturing people as an engineer or designer, but you never really knew how much they could really bring to a party when I saw them work as a team. It was just something to see. You don't really see that kind of effort too often. And it really showed me what you can really accomplish when people get together and have a common goal, which was make that place run. And it just worked. But that was a big crisis. There were a lot of other things. We went out to plants and would see things and how to do things better. And again, I was fortunate, because some of the things I designed that wouldn't go together, I was able to appreciate a viewpoint from the manufacturing end and the assembly end that I never got as a pure planner designer type from the other end. So it broadens your scope, and it lets you understand that it's not important to just design the part, but to design the part for manufacturability, processing, assembly, and so on. And that's been really a valuable aid in the rest of my career, because they're able to bring those disciplines together.
The Auto Assembly Division then presented you with a new set of challenges. This time you had to put the thing together.
Yeah, keep it together. And you don't know how many times I cussed out the engineers because we couldn't put it together. But that was true, though. It was very, in those days, the engineer would make a drawing and throw it over a wall, and the manufacturer would pick it up a few months before production and spend a couple of months proving why it wouldn't work rather than how it would work.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a big wall between them, and the name of the game was, let's try and break down that wall. So,
did you help?
Well,
you feel your efforts?
I helped. I think I did. I can, I don't want to sound like boasting or anything, but I remember Don Bastian, who didn't like engineers. He just didn't like engineers, because he knew he had to live with some of the things that we as engineers used to put out. He called me in when he made me a chief engineer, and he said, Lou, if there's one guy that is an engineer that I would pick in the whole company to come to manufacturing, it's you. And I thought that was one of the best compliments I ever got. But it's because, maybe because I had an understanding of manufacturing a little bit, and I could relate to their problems. And I always said, if I ever got back, I'm going to make sure that we do mesh, and we do things concurrently rather than sequentially. And that's been the essence of this Taurus program, as you know.
Right, a team.
Yeah. But it was really the knocking down the walls was really what Phil Caldwell, that's why he sent me to Europe, because I had had both disciplines. And in fact, that's the way he put it. He said he wanted me to break down the wall between engineering and manufacturing in Europe.
This was, when did that take place?
In 73.
So that's fairly soon.
September of 73.
The AAD chief engineer.
Yeah.
How did that come about? You mentioned Mr. Caldwell. What else was involved?
Well, there's in that, you know, they wrote a book on, let's call it Fiesta. Seidler,
yes,
wrote
right,
a book.
Yeah.
It's in there. It's a real true story. But
I've seen it, but maybe our listeners have. Okay.
But we were busy trying to launch the 73 Mustang. It was called Mustang 2 then, mm-hmm. at Dearborn.
Right.
And I kept getting this phone call. This one, it was a, we were going to start production on Monday, what we called training bills, and it was a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And I got this phone call from Phil Caldwell, and I was over in Dearborn Assembly, so my secretary called me over there, and I said, well, just tell him I'll call him back. He was the executive vice president of international operation then. And so I was trying to get we had some last minute problems we were trying to fix up at Dearborn. So he called three times, and he finally called me personally over at Dearborn Assembly, and he said, I want to see you right away. And I said, Phil, because I knew known Phil because he was our executive vice president before he moved to that. Oh, he was Bastion's boss, see? And so I had known him, and didn't know him, you know, like a friend or anything, but I just knew how to talk to him anyway. And I said, I'm busy, I'll see you Monday. I gotta, you know, we got these last minute problems. He said, you come over here right now. So I dropped everything, and wow, you know, I'm in trouble. And he called me in his office, and he told me that the company had decided to do this small car, Fiesta.
Right.
But beyond that, there was a lot of trouble in Europe on engineering and manufacturing not getting together and walls. And he said, because of my background, he wanted me to go over there and not only lead the Fiesta team, but to, you know, do the other cars as well and break down the barriers. So that was a Friday night, and my wife and I, the next day, flew to New York because I didn't even have a passport.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get a passport, and the next week we went to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It was that quick,
wow.
That simple.
So they had they'd been working on the, I think the code name was Bobcat, wasn't it, initially?
Yeah, but it was here.
Yeah,
it was
here.
Worked on here.
And they decided to introduce it in Europe as a
yeah.
new generation small
yes.
car.
Yes, to compete in the B market, which
right.
is a market smaller than Escort.
Which you didn't
we
have
had never competed in Europe in the B segment before, and we wanted to get a presence really in southern Italy and in Spain and that, where there were high, very big volume of the small cars, so we decided to do it. So this.
So they had given the go
yeah,
on that, and you
yeah.
were to be the project.
Yeah.
More than the project
I was
manager.
The vice president of engineering for Ford of Europe.
Right. This was quite a
And I replaced I replaced Bert Andren.
Did you?
Yes, who was over there in that capacity then. And prior to him was Pizzali. Maybe you know Pizzali that was over there. His name was Pizzali.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
He was he was formerly head of body engineering here, but he was sent over to Europe, and he was there quite a while. Then Bert Andren was there for a short while, and then I was sent over there to take over the vice president of engineering. And Bob Alexander, who again was here, was sent over there as the vice president, corporate vice president of product development,
uh-huh.
which had engineering, planning, and styling, design center.
Did you report to him?
I reported to Bob Alexander.
Yeah.
And I was a European vice president, but not a corporate vice right. president at the time.
Well, without going into too many details, things weren't going too well, were they? They needed
it,
us.
Yeah.
Someone
yeah.
had to ride herd on these
yeah.
on these separate units.
Yeah.
And what was Mr. Caldwell's charge to you when he told you this? What did he say? What did he want you to do?
I had a few things to do. We kind of made like a contract, I guess, because I was concerned personally that I had six children and they were all in different school ages, and I didn't want to. you know, disrupt their education. So we were very concerned, and my wife was also, but I said, okay, I'll go, and I'll, you know, try and break down the barriers was one.
Yeah.
Try and make it, it was trying, you know, break down the barriers between manufacturing and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And really the product development, not just engineering.
Yeah, right.
Make sure they make their dates. They were proliferating production dates all the time.
Keep moving them ahead.
Yeah, they just didn't have any discipline in the timing system or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's do the best job we know how to do and make the financial returns we have to on the Bobcat,
yeah.
It was called at the time. So those were the three charges.
Was design involved in your
yeah,
also?
Yeah. Well, I had engineering only at the time when I went over there.
Who was the head of design at that time?
The head of design was Joe Oros.
Joe was still there?
Yes, O-R-O-S, yeah. And the head of planning was Ralph Peters.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And Ralph Peters, Oros, and myself reported to Bob Alexander.
Right.
Then he had, you know, controller and those other support groups.
So the now the Fiesta is underway, at least in terms of the Bobcat.
It was underway here, but it was just transferred over there.
Just transferred, and they really need a steady hand on the engineering.
Yeah, and what happened, we redesigned the whole car.
Did you?
Because the one that was over here wasn't really for a European market. The suspensions weren't any good. The brakes weren't, you name it. It was strictly an advanced project, and we had to redo the whole thing, and it turned out to be a very, very fine little car.
What were some of the problems you encountered in developing the Fiesta?
Well, there were a lot of problems before the Fiesta on some of the programs they had over there.
Yeah.
But
how did you solve those?
Just by working with manufacturing. One of the first, I guess, well, funny story anyway. The first meeting I had, because I had people that, I had directors in Germany, directors in Britain, and I called a meeting with the group when I first went over there, and I said, I guess I was kind of like a dictator, maybe, in that era. And I called them, and I told them about the problems that I had heard of that they were having,
yeah,
about the lack of cooperation and things like that. It was really bad. The engineers weren't even allowed in the assembly plants, and the assembly people wouldn't even talk to the engineering. And I told them that I had no, you know, extra grind, that I've been both disciplines, and then I told him about the Pozzali was very well liked over there, but he was very mild.
Genius.
And he was I told him that I explained the difference between a northern Italian and a southern Italian at our first meeting. I told him a northern Italian, when he kisses you, that means he likes you, but if a southern Italian like me kisses them, they're in trouble. So they all walked out of there shaking in their boots, because they figured they really had a real jerk over there this time. but it worked out very good, I thought, because I was able to. And the manufacturing people are really like a cult. If they know they can trust you, they'll tell you anything they want to tell you. But if they think you're going to turn it around and use it against them, they will shut up and they won't tell you a thing.
Mm, yeah.
Having come from manufacturing was the best thing that could have happened to me, because I got with the manufacturing people over there right off the bat, asked them what they wanted, put it down on paper so I could see it, and then I proceeded to knock off those lists and accommodate everything. Once they saw that we were dedicated to help them, then the things really start smoothing up, because then they roll in all of their problems, their concerns, and we work together, and we really fashioned a team.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I'll give you an example on the Fiesta, because the Fiesta was just in the design stage getting kicked off then. We had 1,000 days to job one, over 3 years, less than 3 years for job one, working days. The cars,
tight schedule.
Yeah, but the cars were designed, and they were designed so that they'd leak water. The seals were copied like a Capri, and the assembly plant people would say they were going to leak, and nobody in engineering listened to them. I did things, and I don't want you to think, you know, I'm bragging or anything, but I was instrumental in calling the assembly plant people. In that particular case, it was the guy that ran the Star Louis plant, Reiner Jaderman, and he said, J-A-U-D-E-R-M-A-N, it's a German spelling.
Right, right.
But most Germans could speak very good English over there, and I couldn't speak any German, but we were able to communicate real well anyway, because they spoke English. But he said, they'd come in with all their bitches. Well, the car that was over here wasn't going to be any good because of this, because of that, because it was going to leak water. And he says, you got to design it so it won't leak water. I turned to him, I says, Reiner, I'm not going to design that car. I says, you're going to design that third door so it doesn't leak. And I says, then when you design it, when you show me how you want it, then I'll have my engineers draw it for you that way. And he says, is that right? Yeah. I said, we'll do that.
He'd never heard that before.
He never heard that before. But he designed that thing, and it never leaked because he designed it so it was all in a plane so that he, the maker of the car, mm-hmm. knew that it wasn't going to leak. And to this day, we don't have any water leaks on Fiesta. It's a funny, Dave, I always tell him when we went into job one, I used to tell him, is it leaking? He'd say, no, Everaldi, it don't leak. I said, hell, you wouldn't tell me even if it did leak. He says, yeah, that's right. But it's all part of the whole thing. If you can get the team pulling in the same direction toward a singleness of purpose.
Exactly.
You know, why should we fight about whether the design should be X or Y? The only thing that counts is whether the product is right, and if X is better than Y, let's all get aboard and implement X. You know, that's if you can use that philosophy and bring the team together, the team approach is what I call the way to do it. It sure pays off. The Fiesta has been it was probably, I think, the first car that we ever did as a company that not only made its return, but better than its return, its business return, and it's still doing very well over there.
Yes.
I'm really proud to be a part of that program.
Better, right?
It was, in its time, the biggest investment our company has ever made. You know? And, you know, I was proud to be a part of it. And they just, I've got a tremendous respect for the European engineers and manufacturers. They're just a good bunch to work with.
The Germans are great.
The Germans and the Brits.
And the
Brits are, we made a lot of good friends over there that we still communicate with. And it was a very enjoyable experience.
Were you involved with the plant in Valencia?
Yeah, quite a bit. Bill Hayden and I used to fly there once a week at least.
After the decision was made, it was quite a departure, was it not?
From
having, well, you've never been in Spain before.
No, that's right. Yeah, it was a very big investment because we had never spent that. It was $860 million program. We'd never spent that kind of money. About half of that was product and half of it was facilities. And that was a big investment in the, we took these, you know, orange groves and made a plant out of it. But we sent the people from Saar Louis, a lot of key people from Saar Louis went down there to run it initially. S-A-A-R, like the Saar River,
right.
And then L-O-U-I-S, Saar Louis plant.
Now, where was that located?
In southern Germany.
Oh, southern Germany,
yes.
Near the Saar.
We built Fiestas in that plant first.
That was your pilot plant.
And then 6 months later, we went to Valencia. And we moved the German management to Valencia to make sure we brought that on stream right.
Is that the Castilian pronunciation?
Valencia.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
That's good.
Yeah. Sounds like you're lisping.
No. So you moved the whole operation right from Zara
yeah.
to Valencia.
That was one of the first programs that, in fact, I remember I mentioned about meeting job one dates.
Right.
We met job one dates on the other car, but the Fiesta, for the first time, and this gave Europe a push. The job one date was in August, and we made it in May. We made it in May because Bill Hayden. Well, Bill Hayden was ahead on his. Bill Hayden was the vice president of manufacturing.
H-A-Y-D-E-N.
He's still in that capacity over there. He was able to do such a good job on the powertrain that he was ready to go early, and the rest of the car was ready, and we pulled it ahead. But I functioned as a vice president of Ford of Europe. I went over there in the fall of 73 until 75. In May of 75, Bob Alexander was asked to come back here, and I became a corporate vice president in May of 1975.
And the Fiesta is a success?
And at that time I had product development, then I had Bob's job, which was product development, styling, which included styling, planning, and engineering.
And advanced vehicles as well.
Yeah, and advanced over there as well. Yep. Yeah. My chief designer there was Jack Telnack.
Yes, yes.
And my planner was Eric Riker, later Jim Donaldson. And my engineer was Ron Miller, who's still the vice president of engineering over there.
Jack sort of made his reputation over there too, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's become.
Then a couple years later, Jack came back and then I came back.
Yeah.
From Europe.
So this is quite a. The Fiesta, the success is assured. You've got a great product, both from a consumer standpoint and from a safety engineering standpoint. What was your, did you get into the Granada at this point?
Oh yeah, we did all the cars, yeah. We did a, when I was there, we did a new Escort.
Did you?
Yeah, which was, Phil Caldwell really planned that car when he was over there. It was called the Brenda, was the code name.
Brenda.
And we did the front end, was all changed on that. And then we did a new, a facelifted Taunus Cortina, which is now called the Sierra.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Right.
And we did a new...
That came out of the Taunus Cortina.
Yes. Yeah. But we did the first common Taunus Cortina. It was the first common car between Britain and Germany. We did that while I was there. And then we did a new... a major change on the European Granada in the suspension system, because they had a very sophisticated independent rear suspension, but they didn't have it really tuned to get the benefit out of it, so it's become a very good system, and we did that one, and that was all before Fiesta. Fiesta was the last one.
That's true, yeah.
And then after we built about 20,000 Fiestas, completely retuned the geometry on the Granada independent rear suspension, which included the incorporation for the first time of nitrogen-filled shock absorbers. Now, why nitrogen-filled? They give the ride more consistency. When you have a standard type shock absorber that has air in it, it just bubbles and it's inconsistent for ride control and sometimes for fade. It'll fade quicker than a gas-filled shock. So by incorporating the nitrogen as the filler in there, it keeps the shock absorber from getting cavitation or aeration in the in the fluid, and it keeps a firm control on it, and it less fade in the shocks. Now, our European Granada was the first one to incorporate that over in our European fleet. Since then, most of our American cars here have gas-filled shock absorbers.
Had that been a continental innovation? Someone had.
I think it was Bill Stein or some outfit in Germany. I think was the first one to do it.
Fascinating. Well, at this point, you felt that you successfully launched the Fiesta, and you'd like to get back to Germany.
Yeah, I thought it was time to come back, and I.
It's about 1975.
Yeah, 1976. In the fall of 1976, I came back, and. My function, when I came back, there was a position created for me called Advanced Vehicles Development, AVD as we called it. And I reported, I was adjacent to Gene Bourdais in the Design Center location. And both Gene and I reported to William Clay Ford. And he in turn reported to the president, Lee Iacocca. So my function in Advanced Vehicles Development was to set up, at that time, the Advanced Vehicles had paper-type programs and never did any real hardware development. But because of the problems we had in the advanced work on the Fiesta, I wanted to put a development function in there to do hardware work and build cars rather than just papers during the advanced stage. So I was fortunate enough to get that approved through Mr. Ford and Mr. Iacocca. And we put up how the term was defined, advanced vehicle development. We did an advanced vehicle function for the company that was 5 years beyond the normal function of job one. And we built cars, we evaluated hardware, and then from that helped that hardware decide which way we should go in our product strategy and our product planning process. And my function was to basically do that for the Ford world, not just Europe, I mean not just North America, but Europe as well. And we built a facility that we still have out in Beach Daly and Michigan Avenue where we do product development work on advanced cars, and we still build hardware there. In fact, that facility now builds hardware for Don Kopka, for any concept car that we do. So it's been a valuable aid in helping us, the company, decide where we should go.
At this point, it's become fairly sophisticated, has it not? The interaction between body engineering, product planning, and design has become much more sophisticated and much more as an evaluation.
Integrated, more interdependent, really.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's why my people were located in the design center, because I had the planners and the engineers and the development engineers, and I would fund Gene Bourdais to do the properties, the aesthetics of the things that I wanted from a functional viewpoint. And we had about 12 or 15 different concepts of vehicles. One of them was the, what we called the Minimax at the time, if you're familiar, yes. Mm-hmm. Which you can see running around on the roads now. It's a Chrysler van. In fact, we did that.
I had Poker to go with him.
We built a prototype for $750,000, and in fact, he borrowed it for a week before he left the company and scanned it. He did.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. I got the dimensions on it, and dimension on his cars, and the right, that really happened.
I guess Don Alarosa was also involved in that.
He did some of the design on it, but that was a nice. Our car was more innovative than the one that's on the road now. We had foldable, stowable seats. We had a ramp. We had a bumper that folded out as a ramp, so a handicapped person could get wheeled in. We had so many.
They came up with sort of a skeleton of your vehicle.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a nice, and we did things like we took a Fiesta and called it a Fiesta Fantasy. We took a Fiesta and we were able to make a pickup truck, a convertible, and a hardtop out of it just by changing tops on it, modular things like that. We did about 11 different types of cars before we ended up settling with the Taurus, which is now called the Taurus program, or DN5 program.
But basically the engineering package is the key to the product.
The upfront package, if you can, very simplistically, Dave, if you can plan, if you can do the strategic planning properly and then the product planning properly and get all of the input up front, the implementation or the execution of the car through the engineering and the styling phases and the manufacturing and assembly becomes, I don't want to oversimplify it, but it becomes very simple, because if you've got a good plan in place and the plan's flexible enough to adapt to changes, which will always occur during a program because you're always testing the external environment and responding to that and so on, then I think you've, and that's the way to do it. And I think that's, once we settled throughout, when I came back in 76, the end of 76, we had a Panther, which is now the Crown Vic and the town car. We had finished up that, which Harold McDonald had started. He was in the staff function at that time, and Bob Alexander was over here running NAO product development. And we finished up the Panther, because when I came back, he gave that responsibility to me, and we called it advanced vehicle development. And once that was done, then we went into all these different concept things about front-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive, and configuration, and how big a car, and so on. From 1977, all of that culminated with the Taurus program, which really started in the end of 79, the beginning of 80.
So at this point in the late 70s, you're on the brink of an all new ground up kind of vehicle.
Yeah,
it will culminate in.
Now that all new ground up, that all new, as I call it, clean sheet of paper approach,
yeah,
Dave,
right.
didn't come about easy, because our function in advanced vehicle development was to look over the whole world and put a product planning strategy in place that said, here's where we want to be 5, 6, 8, 10 years from now. And then we would review that strategy and plan with the operational people called North American, where I'm at now, with Europe over there. And then we'd formulate our strategy against their strategies and then review that independently with our management called the OCE. At that time it was ICOCA and so on. And then later on, Phil Caldwell, Peterson, and so on. And so our strategies were sometimes, and a lot of times, designed to be different, because the operational people, like North America, had pressures that said, don't spend money, keep what you got today, don't, you know, use the same engine, things like that.
Move more slowly.
My strategy, my charge in AVD was to, don't be inhibited by that. Where should we as a company be to have the best product and the best competitive edge that we know how to get, you know, in the mid-80s and the late-80s. So we were on different wickets going in, but it ended up good, because we decided to end up with, you know, it was called Sigma. It was called a lot of different names.
What were the code names?
Well, originally it was Raven, then it
Raven,
was Sigma, and then when we changed the car again, it was called Taurus. We
codenamed
it Taurus. Yes. Taurus started, the Taurus name began in the end of 79 and really the middle of 80 when we really start calling it Taurus.
We've got some time to, let's if I can ask you to develop that at some length, that whole Taurus Able program, how it started, who were the main innovators, and what were your role in the whole affair?
Well, we started out, as I said, you know, it starts back in 1977 with
ABD.
Yeah, when we looked out and we said, where do we want to be? At that time, the fuel crisis was on. There were a lot of things. There were a lot of external pressures that said, big is no good. Make it small.
And you had some interim cars that fill that need.
Yeah. Well, we had about 11 different concepts that we were looking at as an advanced product strategy. Right. My planners were looking at, who's John Risk, was my head planner. He's over here with me yet now, mm-hmm. And we presented things like decision trees. We went through a decision tree analysis. We went through strategic analyses and profit analysis. All those things to try and say to the management of our company, here's the way our direction ought to be in the mid 80s. Because at that time we were already planned for the escort. We knew we had to do an escort here. The derivative off the escort called Tempo Topaz was also being planned. We were asked to look at what do we do beyond that in ABD, in advanced vehicle development. And North American strategy was to try and make the Crown Vic or the Grand Marquis were just going to disappear from the scene, go away, never be heard from. And our strategy over there was keep those around, but also slide in this other sophisticated, family-oriented car that was really a six-passenger car, and we ended up calling it Taurus. We had a lot of debates on it. We had a lot of opinion back and forth, and it all ended up at a meeting we had in the spring of 1980 up in the boardroom.
That was the first.
The first one was in 79 when we decided to go configuration. We had all these layouts and front wheel drive and rear wheel drive and fore and aft. But it ended up, the summary of that is, it ended up for the maximum space and the minimum weight in a family type car, we went to the configuration we have now. In the spring of 80 is where we decided that that was a trip we were going to take. We had a low investment trip called do with what you got and minimize investment and so on, but it wasn't going to give us the product that we thought we'd have to have to really have a leading edge in the market. Mm-hmm. We had the AVD proposal, which was basically, and the whole proposal was for the company, if we could afford it, to go with Taurus.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I never forget that meeting. It was a very interesting meeting because
who attended? What types?
Oh, it was Phil Caldwell. It was Peterson. It was Red Poling. It was Will Caldwell. It was all the
decision makers.
Yeah, all the OCE.
Right.
And
did you make a presentation?
Yes, we made the presentation on the me and my people made the presentation on the whole thing, both sides of it.
Because
we
had working with you at this point too.
ABD. No. Gene Bordenay was still there at the time, yeah. Don was there also, so was Talnack. But at this meeting, Gene Bordenay was there. Don Kopka wasn't a vice president at the time yet. But it turned out that we went through all the pros and cons and said it was going to take $3.25 billion to do this Taurus program. At that time, it was just codenamed Taurus for everything. And I remember Phil Caldwell said, a memorable thing that still lived with the program all the way through. He said, when we got all through, he said, we're going to do it. And I tell you, it took guts because we were losing $1.6 billion or whatever,
yes.
Projected to lose even more. So he said, we're going to do it. He said, but one thing, we're going to make sure that we answer the question, why buy Taurus and what's the best in class feature? What are the compelling reasons that this car is going to sell as we go through the program design and execution? And then, quality has to be the cornerstone of the program. And then Don Peterson said a memorable thing, too. He probably doesn't even remember where he said it, but I do. He said, let's make sure, in his soft voice, which yes. he says, let's make sure that we do common things uncommonly well in the execution. Isn't that nice?
That's nice.
I hung on to that,
right?
Hung on to that for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
But and so we all marched out with one direction, was to do the Taurus. In order to do those things, in order to do that charge, and again, I was fortunate enough to lead the Taurus team, we thought we had to really set up a team that really brought, and I call it simply, brought the downstream disciplines upstream.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, then you could get all the input of the people that were going to make the parts, that were going to service the parts, that were going to assemble the parts, that were going to sell the parts, that are responsible for legal and safety, whatever, you get their input way up where they could affect the product. again, as I told you, when I was in AED, I'd come to the engineer and I'd say, I want to change this joint. They'd say, it's already too old, you know, see you next year. You can't wait till you're at the end. And we decided for product efficiency and for productivity improvements, we wanted to do things that were better than the present cars out there, more sophisticated assembly methods and manufacturing methods. So we wanted to go into automation. We wanted to go into modular. We were talking about going into modular construction day before GM even heard of the word. I mean, they're talking about things in the future. And if you go down to Atlanta and you go down to Lima, you go to Livonia, you'll see them on our Taurus and Sable car right now. Mm-hmm. And I told that to journalists. They didn't believe me. They went out and they're writing the stories on what they saw. It's simple as that.
Of course, you also brought your team concept from Ford of Europe to bear on this.
In Ford of Europe, basically, we did mainly engineering and manufacturing. In the Taurus, much broader scope because we brought all the disciplines in early. And I mean all of them. They're depicted on this on the team chart that I'm going to leave you with. But it's basically as much as 5 years before production. In the case of the assembly plant, it was 1981. In May of 1981, we went to Atlanta. We had picked the assembly plant way back then. It was going to build this car. We went to Atlanta, put layouts on the wall. We said, Pete, and we had hourly people there. We had salary people there. First time we involved the hourly people, by the way. We said, we want to do a car like this. It's going to be built in this plant. Now, you tell us what you want to see in this car so that you don't have the problems you have on quality, so that you can build it more efficiently, so that you can build it with less in-system damage, so that you can put it together with inherent quality, so you can throw the parts at it rather than fit everything gently, that things like that. They came through with all kind of, because they said nobody ever asked us. They came through with all kinds of input, and we put it in the car. A couple of months ago, I was down there with the cars, and I had hourly people coming up to me and looking at the cars and saying, that's my idea, that's my idea.
Great.
And that's the most enthusiastic and dedicated approach I've ever seen. When I get the hourly people talking like that, I know he's going to build it good because it's his baby. It's not anymore management's baby or whatever. It's his baby, so I know he's going to put it together right. Tremendous spirit.
You're harking back to that experience with the seal of
yeah,
the rear
yeah.
door.
It's a tremendous gratifying experience to see now, just before a month or two before job one, to see those same people that said, here's what I wanted, come back and tell you, my God, you really listened. You know, that's something that has got to give us product perfection like we've never had in any product we've done in our company. And that's really a gratifying experience. But it wasn't just the assembly plant, Dave. It was, we went to legal and safety people back before designs were put on paper. We said to them, we asked them, what would you know, you deal with Washington, you deal with the external environment. What do you see coming on the horizon that should be baked in the car so we didn't have to patch it in later? And again, that experience, when we did the Fiesta in Europe, we did it strictly for Europe. When North America came to us at 11th hour and said they wanted some cars over here, we had to put about 200 pounds in the car and about $150 to patch safety things to meet the American standards. So we asked this question on Taurus, what do you want? The legal and safety people came back with you should plan on higher speed, you should plan on better fuel economy, you should plan on about 10 or 11 different items. This car, as a result of that, it has baked in at no additional cost, higher front and rear crash speeds than government requirements, higher front and rear bumper requirements, side intrusion improvements never heard of on any other car, doors that open after these higher crashes without tools, which is no law, but maybe it'll come. We had high-mounted brake lamps in this car before they became a law for 86. They were already in. We didn't have to panic and put them in. So that, you know, if you can get that upfront involvement, we went to dealers. We went to Bob Bondurant, Jackie Stewart, Lynn St. James, car experts for handling, for ride control, things like that. We went to dealer councils. We went to service manager councils. We went to manufacturing people, stamping people. How should we design the stampings? How do we develop the car different for robotics, for automatic installation of parts, for modular construction of powertrains and so on? Throughout this whole circle, all of those disciplines, and you'll see names there from all the various plants that are represented on the team. And we collected, we thought they would get a couple hundred, what we call watts or inputs. There were 1,401 inputs to the program, and about more than half of those have been incorporated in the program. And there's a, you know, as a result of that, this is really a team car. It's got people have involvement, people have equity in it that felt like outsiders before. I go around to suppliers. I've visited, since the first of the year, almost 100 suppliers. And they tell me what they've done to make this car, down to the attention to detail. Again, that thing, common things, uncommonly well. Got windshield wiper blades that are longer than any blade in a car in its class, and they wipe all the way up against the, I don't know what kind of car you got, but it probably needs a blind spot like that.
Okay.
These wipe all the way up against the A-pillar, dynamic safety enhancement. All the switches to go on, they're convex, to go off, they're concave. The attention to detail has been just fabulous. Why? Because the people that have been involved in that discipline bring it up front, and it's been put in. Even the carpet, even the guy that gives us a carpet, a Maslin Carpet Company, he's indexed that carpet in the station wagon load floor so that the nap all lays in one direction. We've never done that before. Why? We don't know anything about carpet, but he does. I said, did you ever do it before? You know, why? Nobody really asked us as carpet people what they wanted. No, just the little things that, you know, really, me and my guys are totally confident we're going to have fits and finishes and a quality product like we never saw before because we've got that involvement.
The involvement in the planning.
Yeah, and the involvement of the hourly people that make the product.
Mm-hmm.
And the most, I guess if I had to say one phrase, they know we care, and they in turn care.
Right.
And singleness of purpose. You know, the purpose is to make the Ford Motor Company product the best in the world, and I think we got it. There's no question, this car is going to set a standard for the industry and its class.
Well, it certainly looks great from what I've seen in the advanced photographs.
Well, when you drive it, Dave, isn't that just really? A pretty face? It drives great.
I've got to drive it. Interesting that one in your, at least in your final planning, you included a station wagon, which is sometimes an afterthought, but this apparently, from what I've seen in the photographs, it's really an integral part.
The station wagon has been a we've been around with these cars since they were, you know, the public introduction in January in L.A. to about 50 different cities, showing the cars to get, because they are different.
Right.
We want to make sure we get some, you know, feedback that says we're on the right track, which they've been received. But your point on a station wagon, our planning volume was about 30% of the program, and we think that's very conservative because we've had more people say, it's like you're talking, that the wagon is not a wagon. In fact, when you drive it, the journalists that drive it, they tell us the same thing, because the independent rear suspension, which is unique, you don't have the loads don't feed up in the floor, and you don't have the boominess that you get in the wagon, and it handles like a dream. And Seppos, who writes for Car and Driver,
yeah.
I don't know if you read his, because when they came in, I told him, I'm not going to tell you, you go out and drive the cars, you guys know how to drive the cars, and they wrote their own articles. His concluding statement was, if you're in the market for a mink, I'd wait for a sable.
That's right.
That was beautiful.
I read that. That's a fabulous article. But you come up with an incredibly, I can't see how it will miss. It's such a gorgeous piece of machinery.
Yeah. From one end, and this is what I'd like to leave you that.
Yes.
That question, why buy Taurus? We turned it into, you know, every time we had design review and what we call best in class, we examined over 400 different operating elements in the car, from crank handles all the way through, and tried to answer that question, why buy Taurus? When I say Taurus, I mean Taurus Sable, because that was the code name of the program.
Yeah.
And through the 4.5 years, we've accumulated about 31 pages of answers, which I'm going to leave with you.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to, you know, read the 31 pages, but you can see things through there, like some of the things I've talked about. 5-year corrosion protection, do-it-yourself underhood items highlighted in yellow for customer convenience on dipstick, so that people would tell us, I don't even know where the dipstick is. So everything's color keyed, the hood goes up automatically, a woman doesn't have to lift it up manually and put a prop rod, things like that, because we did research on self-service stations. About 70% of the people service their own cars now, so all of that kind of stuff is in here. In addition, the serviceability, which is a very important feature to customers, as they told us, they wanted to service their own cars. We've got 6 pages of things that you can service yourself and don't have to take to the dealer or the mechanic built into the car.
And you made it much easier for them to do it.
Yeah, like just like accessibility is there, like yeah. like power steering or pulleys on a car. Sometimes when you turn a corner, you hear a belt squeal. That means your belt's loose. You take it in, and it's $10 or $15. On the Taurus Sable powertrain, there's a simple jack screw. You just turn it a couple turns, and you can tighten your own belt free. Mm-hmm. All you need is a wrench or a pair of pliers.
Incredible.
Things like that are all the way through the car, Dave. And when the customers see that, they say, gee, you've listened. We think it's great. You know, things like women told us in initial surveys that grocery bags fall over in a wagon or in a car. We've got an optional net that you can pull over the grocery bags so they don't fall over. We went to the supplier on the wagon. We said, our door opens like a umbrella. Can you do anything for us? Because we for tailgate parties, they come up with this innovative picnic tray on the wagon that flips right out. You know, you can have a little tailgate party. Just things like that are, that's what the people are telling us when we show them the hardware now that, you know, we've really hit the mark with them.
You said you projected 30%
for the wagon.
Wagon. I think a little much higher.
I think it will, too, yeah, based on all the good reports I've seen. Yeah.
Let me just show you one little curve. You probably have heard this all before, and forgive me. Most of the articles have been 90% complimentary have mentioned that there's more than a fleeting resemblance to the Audi 5000. Did you consciously for engineering and design antecedents, did you look at what had been done or what was being done at that time?
No, yet no and yes, all right, I put it in that order. When the hard points, as we call them, the functional styling of the car, which we call hard points, were established, and when the skin, the aesthetics were established, the styling of the car, the Audi was not around. When the Audi did come out, the Audi 5000, because we had an Opel Senator that isn't sold in this country, we had about 5 different cars that we thought were best in class in the world that we were looking at for images.
Yeah.
And we always do that. And so GM uses our cars for images and so on. That's a common thing.
Yeah.
When the Audi came out, we examined the Audi again for functional images and found that its steering was even better than the image we had. So we jumped on Audi for another steering image, but we didn't jump on Audi for any styling cues. Our styling cues were done. We had flush glass into our car. Audi was the first one to come out with the flush glass, but our system is completely different than the Audi system.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see the two cars side by side, our Sable is probably a little more forward looking than but the Audi was, if you ask Jack Telnock, I'm sure he'll tell you, because I've asked him too, the Audi was not in existence when he did his car.
Well, that's good to know. Well, in the time remaining, Mr. Baraldi, would you examine at some length how this episode impinged on your, was this sort of a culmination of all that you'd worked for, all that you'd studied for?
Yeah,
this whole project of a team working together?
Yeah.
Which is largely your concept as well.
I don't know about, if it's my concept, it's probably, I got it from the people I worked for along the line, but it really, I've been extremely fortunate. In their time, the two largest investments that our company's ever made, I've been involved with, you know, the Fiesta and now this, the Taurus program. So that gives me a great deal of, job satisfaction.
Yes.
But beyond that, I think it does represent the team involvement that, to me, if we're going to compete on a worldwide basis, is the only way to do things. Now, I don't think I invented it. I'm sure I didn't invent it, but I've been fortunate to have worked in the disciplines that that give me an understanding of the different ends of the business, and so I can understand the importance of the team toward getting the final product. And it's really the face-to-face contact that you make throughout the execution of the program and the involvement of the people that are doing the job. You can, I'm sure you heard that before, you can design the best widget in the world, but if nobody can make it and make it reliably and make it repeatably, make it function right, and to me, a program comes home right if you can do four things, Dave. And then it culminates in a fifth. If you can make it look right, feel right, function right, and fit right before it comes to the assembly plant where you're going to do mass production. If you can do those things, the fifth thing is do them before you get to the assembly plant, you've got a shot at really making a good quality car. And the way you do that is to get the people involved that are in those disciplines, suppliers inside and out, purchasing people. They've been an integral part of this since the start, all the manufacturing people, and so on. And work, again, have them work hourly and salary toward the common goal of product integrity, then you got it made. Because nobody argues about you screwed up or I screwed up. There's only one goal. It's product integrity and value to the customer. And if we don't have that, we're all going to be out of business. So with that common goal, you can bring a team together very easily.
We've certainly succeeded in this point, Dave.
Well,
what's down the
not
line
yet,
for you?
Not yet, Dave.
Well, I think you will.
The success will be when the cars come off the assembly line and how well they're accepted in the showrooms in the fall, in October of this year.
Well, here in
if that comes out, I think we'll be all right.
I think you will. In the short time we have remaining, what's down the road for you? This, of course, you're listening to it for the next year or so.
Well, down the road, Taurus and Sable, the way we've implemented the program, I think some people think it's the greatest, but I keep telling everybody it's a start. It's
right.
The start of a different approach, and you'll be hearing a lot of it from competitors. They've talked about it already, of simultaneous rather than sequential operation. And it's simply, that's it. Simultaneous, that's bringing everybody together up front rather than doing it sequentially. And we are institutionalizing that at Ford. And we are focusing on the customer more at Ford. And there's a lot of things coming down the road after Taurus